What is the future of healthcare under the American Healthcare Act, and will it pass the Senate? An expert speaks out just ahead. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us anytime or on iTunes. Stream us live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, too. And just ahead, there could be a vote soon in the U.S. Senate on the American Healthcare Act. Will it pass? We'll talk about it and the future ramifications of healthcare reform in this country as we speak with Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, big changes coming to some major FDOT projects around town. A new housing project opening up for homeless veterans in Jacksonville. And the sweet success of the Maple Street Biscuit Company. We'll tell you about that, all of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, top Republican leaders in Washington this week are trying to tamp down expectations that the Senate will pass an overhaul of the nation's healthcare system. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is promising a vote on the issue to his caucus, but not necessarily passage. Why? Well, moderate and more conservative Republicans can't come to terms on what an overhaul might look like, in particular on issues like Medicaid and how to cover people with pre-existing conditions. Meanwhile, a new report out in the last few days by the Congressional Budget Office has underscored a variety of problems moderates have with the bill. It would leave 23 million more people in this country uninsured by the year 2026. Compared to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And it would increase premiums for older and low-income Americans by as much as 850%. So, what does all of this mean for the future of your health insurance? You've probably got a lot of questions. Well, we're talking to the expert to get the answers as he gives his take. It's Pat Garrity, CEO of Florida Blue, and he joins us now in studio with his thoughts on the path ahead for healthcare reform. Pat, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy to be here.
And when it comes to the American Healthcare Act, the future of health insurance in this country, what are your questions for Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page where we're streaming this show live right now. And Pat Garrity, we're waiting to see whether the health care package that passed the House of Representatives can get enough votes, 52 votes to be exact, to become law and make its way through the Senate. As we look at all the jockeying on Capitol Hill about this, you're the CEO of a major insurer. What are your biggest takeaways for what's happening right now with this legislation?
Well, this has been sort of an unprecedented time. As you know, the America's Healthcare Act first didn't get presented for a vote. And then when it finally was, it passed 217 to 213. So that's a narrow win in the House. What we've heard out of the Senate, what we hear repeatedly, is that the package as it left the House would not get through the Senate, that changes would be made in the Senate. And I expect that that's exactly what will happen. The Senate right now is trying to figure out what changes to make in order to get the 52 votes they need.
And the big sticking points among the more moderate-leaning Republican senators seem to include stability for the Medicaid population and also pre-existing conditions, not to mention language that would defund Planned Parenthood. Is that the feedback you're getting?
Well, those are significant issues, absolutely, and those are ones that are really at the top of the list. But also on that list is the cost share reduction. So commonly referred to as CSR, the cost share reduction is the subsidy that allows so many people today to buy their coverage, and that is very much up in the air when we look at America's Healthcare Act, because it has a plan in it to phase the cost share reduction out by 2020. And that's really how many, many people are able to afford their coverage today.
And it's 549-2937. What are your questions about healthcare reform as we welcome Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity? What are your biggest concerns? Say this does pass the Senate. What does that mean for Florida Blue? Say it doesn't. What does that mean for your company?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a big premise. If it passes the Senate as it is out of the House, is a significant issue. I think one of the good things about the bill is that it gives the bridge, if you will, of 2017, 18, and 19 to have the cost share reduction, the subsidy in place. Mm-hmm. That allows for some period of transition. But my concern still is that if in 2020 you didn't have the subsidy, would the tax credits, would the spending accounts be enough to help people buy coverage that they so desperately need? And I think that's a very significant issue in Florida, because 1.6 million people in Florida are covered under the Affordable Care Act. 1.2 million of them received the subsidy. Mm-hmm. So it's a very big economic issue in our state.
Yeah. 549-2937 to join us. In fact, you were the first major insurer to offer coverage through the Obamacare exchanges in every Florida county. What would you say to those who've raised concerns about the way forward for the current setup, saying it's in a death spiral?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's in a death spiral, candidly. It's struggled in some places, but we are the only insurer in Florida who has been in all 67 counties for the whole time. And actually, we intend to be in all 67 counties in 2018 if we have the bill as it is currently configured with the cost share reduction in place. And so that's the big question mark. Will we get that or not? Mm-hmm. But we have competition in Florida. We have three plans that are in place in Florida that compete for the Florida marketplace. And so it isn't in a death spiral. Our plan has been successful. We've enrolled almost 1 million people in the Affordable Care Act enrollment in our state. So we've seen it as something that can work, but it absolutely needs changes.
And what would you, if you were the architect of this legislation, what would you change? And also, is this even politically feasible, since anything that can pass the House is not going to pass the Senate, and vice versa? In particular, in the House, the Freedom Caucus, our own Congressman Ron DeSantis is a member, really hardline Republicans who are just diametrically opposed to some of these expanded coverage pieces.
Yeah, so my personal belief here was that what we needed to do was take this law that was in place, that was an imperfect law, but it covered a lot of people, and modify the law. Make the changes that were necessary so that the law could actually work more effectively than it works today. And what do I mean when I say make some changes? One of the changes is all of the taxes that were loaded into the Affordable Care Act. When people pass taxes in Washington, we often think, oh, well, they taxed device manufacturers or they taxed the insurance industry. Just look at your cable phone bill. When a tax goes through, it comes down to the consumer. So taxes in the Affordable Care Act end up on the consumer's bill, and they cause premiums to go in the opposite direction of affordable. So taking those taxes out of the law, I think, is step one. Mm-hmm. You know, step two is tightening up the way the administration of the plan works. This was not put together in the most effective way. We saw that when the healthcare.gov rolled out. There were many business principles that were sort of missed at the very start of this. And I think we can do a better job of providing the coverage.
And do you think in the long run, given that the Republicans probably will not all get on the same page about this, that we're going to continue with something like what we have now? I look at the quote the other day from former House Speaker John Boehner, and he laughed out loud when people asked him about this. He said, the Republicans are never going to agree on what to do. He's the former Speaker of the House. So are we going to see a future, do you think, Pat Garrity, where we're looking at Obamacare or Obamacare Lite or some version thereof going forward?
Well, I think that's possible. It's hard to know. It really is hard to know because we are in all kinds of conversations, and this has fluctuated very many times. It was very clear that the Republicans didn't actually expect to be in the position to craft the new law. And we've heard this in Washington many, many times. We didn't expect to win. Therefore, we weren't quite ready with the legislation. And they had a lot of time to prepare alternate legislation, which is why the America's Healthcare Act has struggled as much as it has. It really wasn't fully thought out. It was moved through rather rapidly. And now you're having the debate while we're in play on the legislation. And therefore, you aren't finding a broad enough coalition to move it. So it's very possible that this will continue on for quite some time.
All right. And lots of calls, emails, and tweets for Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity. What are your questions? What are your comments about the Republican effort to pass the American Health Care Act? 549-2937. Stephen in Putnam County. Hey, Stephen. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious. I've heard speculation that we're going to have a 20% increase in premiums from our local Blue Cross provider, and I'm wondering if that's tied to the Health Care Act and the reform that's going on. Thank you.
Thank you. Pat?
Yeah, what it's really tied to is whether or not we have the cost share reduction approved by the administration. So if the Trump administration allows for the cost share reduction that is currently part of the Affordable Care Act to go forward, then the rate increases will be modified by that. If they don't allow for the cost share reduction, we estimate that the cost share reduction on its own is worth in the area of 20%. So that will raise rates by that amount in addition to whatever rate increase is necessary. So this is a very big issue and one that actually people need to raise their voice about. We need Washington to continue the cost share reduction.
You actually were in a recent meeting in the Oval Office with the president, is my understanding, and you had the opportunity to make your voice heard directly to him. What was that meeting like?
Well, it was an interesting meeting. I actually was immediately across the table from the president when he said, healthcare, who knew it was this complicated? And I was a person right across the table from him at the time with Vice President Pence to my left.
Did you say, yeah, it's complicated?
we kind of all chuckled at that because everyone in that room could have certainly made that case. You know, when the cameras left the room and the president opened the floor up, I asked the first question. And my question was about cost share reduction. And I wanted to specifically ask about what if we have somebody in Florida who today is, let's say, 60 years old, doesn't make a lot of money. The cost share reduction is allowing them to buy their health care. How would they be covered? And the president called on Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to answer the question. Secretary Price pointed to tax credits, to spending account arrangements, mm-hmm. and the fact that young people will be attracted to that and come into the pool. And I raised back to him that I didn't think that that addressed the full issue because people who are older aren't going to be able to wait for the younger people to adjust the pool over time. And they aren't really waiting on a tax credit that won't be as significant to them as the cost share reduction is today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what CBO has validated for us. They've said that we're going to have 23 million people dropping coverage because they won't get the subsidy that they're getting in today's plan. And that's really what the debate is about. Are we going to continue to help people be covered or not?
All right. Bill is in Ortega. Hey, Bill, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. What I'm about to say is probably irrational because I don't think it would ever be considered, but my wife is from Finland, and they have a single-payer system. They have pay more taxes. But we will all pay more taxes, we will all pay more one way or the other for health care as long as health care the cost of health care continues to go up. Now, you know, people talk about single-payer health care and health care, you know, in other countries. But she has a no-waiting system. She's in a no-waiting system there. If she wants to go to the doctor, she will be seen the same day. There are no long lines. The only thing that's not covered, which I think is correct, are things like cosmetic surgery. But I guess my opinion about this is that I think that this conversation is about healthcare in America is irrational for one reason, and that is that we have many examples around the world where other systems are working perfectly, and we ignore them for the sake of having our own stamp or our own fingerprint on it. And I just don't understand that. I'm going to make one more comment, then I'll get off the line. The same thing's true with coverage and treatment for people that have substance abuse problems and addiction. Portugal, for example, got rid of all of their laws, criminalization of substance abuse, and put that money into treatment. And they have reduced addiction significantly over the past decade. And we continue to have this war on drugs and put people in prison. And it's the same sort of mentality. And I just don't understand. I don't think, you know, it's ever going to change. And it's very discouraging.
Okay, Bill. Yeah, I hear you. Two points from Bill. Thank you, Bill. 2 points from Bill and Ortega. The point about how we handle addiction, that's something we talk about a lot on this program, and we'll continue to. But let me ask you, Pat Garrity, his remark about single payer. And by the way, the other day, or actually the other week, one of your counterparts, Mark Bertolini, the CEO of Aetna, in a private meeting, is reported as having said, single payer, I think we need to have that debate as a nation. Do you agree?
So a number of issues here. First of all, I won't speak for Mark. I know Mark, and he's often one to stir things up. But my point of view on all of this is that what we really are talking about in this country is not about whether we should have a single payer or not. We're talking about universal health care. And people use those terms interchangeably, and actually they're not the same term. Universal health care means everyone is covered. It doesn't really get into the mechanics of how do you make that happen, whether there's a single payer of that or whether there's a variety of payers. Mm-hmm. Many Americans don't realize, for example, that Germany has over 300 health insurers, but they are a universal coverage country, and actually made a delegation trip to from Minnesota to Germany to look at the German health system, because they operate at such a dramatically less amount of the GDP. They're at about 11%. We're at about 18%. And the thing that I asked while there, because I found it fascinating to watch their system operate, was would you be more effective if you went from 300 to 1 in terms of your insurers? And the answer back was, why would we take creativity out of the system? Why would we take competition out of the system? Why would we take innovation out of the system? When you go to one, you give up on all of that competitive environment that helps people do better and strive to do better. And so they absolutely are committed to not going to one payer, but to having a universal coverage of people and a funding source from the government.
And you think that's the way to go?
I think that's worthy of discussion. I'm not sure we can take any one country system and put that in the United States, but I do think it's important to learn lessons from others and make sure that we're improving our system as best we can.
Lots of calls, emails, and tweets. Meanwhile, for Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity, Rob tweets the show, the ACA allowed me to leave my state job and begin a startup company. I'm lucky to be healthy, but my age and a small pre-existing condition would have made this prohibitive to me and my family. The changes being discussed right now will devastate our family's future. Melissa tweets the show, I'm about to be dropped from my parents' insurance. Entering this uncertain landscape with a minimal income is terrifying. Lots of anxiety out there.
Lots of anxiety, and we hear this from our customers as well. One of the things that we put forward is we absolutely believe that pre-existing conditions should be covered. And people may find that interesting for an insurance company to make that statement. But we've made this statement because policies have to be coordinated. And part of a policy coordination was everyone should be covered and pre-existing conditions should go away. Those two things sort of need to happen together. The Affordable Care Act moved us in that direction with more people being covered, but it didn't get the job fully done. But pre-existing condition is something that really shouldn't be part of the landscape. If we go back in the other direction, I think that is a mistake, and I think we do need to keep people covered.
And you mentioned the cost-sharing issue. Here's an email for you from Ed. Who is paying the cost-sharing? The taxpayers?
Yes, it comes out of the taxpayer funding, of course. Everything generates government funding is coming from taxpayers. But the thing about healthcare that's really important for people to understand is if you are not covered and you go to a hospital uninsured, you generate expense for the entire system. So hospitals,
we're paying one way or another.
You're paying one way or another. And so what happens is if we say to people, we don't want you to have healthcare coverage because we don't want to fund you through a tax subsidy, that individual can and does wind up in a very acute state, and they wind up in a hospital for a very expensive procedure. It's better for the whole system to take care of that individual on a well basis to make sure that they aren't in an acute state. The person who ends up in the emergency room uncovered, the hospital has to move that expense to those who have coverage. You're paying for them anyhow.
Adam tweets the show, even if other countries' single-payer systems aren't perfect, our system is clearly broken. Ours could be a hybrid of universal and private. Sort of what you, I think, were just suggesting.
Absolutely. What I'm suggesting is that everyone could be covered, and it could be covered by a private system. You know, Melissa, one of the things I learned in Minnesota was how many people in the Canadian system come to Mayo Clinic, come to Cleveland Clinic, come to the University of Buffalo. They come across those borders when they have really acute care that's necessary.
Let's go to Lydia on the west side. Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So my question is, in all of the discussions going back and forth that I keep hearing, I do not hear anything about whether the one thing that concerns me most will be removed, and that is, right now, you're either paying out the nose, and probably, and for many of us, it's things we can't afford. We pay for insurance, or we pay because we don't have insurance. Is that part of this? Has that even been discussed in reference to removing the requirement that you have insurance or you get dinged on your taxes?
Yeah, thanks for that, Lydia. And here's a tweet for you, Pat, from Woody. He tweets us, I think people having to pay in excess of $3,000 to just get 80-20 coverage is pretty much like not having insurance. This sentiment that we're not on a sustainable path, in other words, I guess. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, so I think what there's a couple of things in the, in these two comments that I want to touch on. One is that you know, in the plans that are in the Affordable Care Act, there are wellness benefits that are covered at full dollar. And so that's an important part of keeping people well in the first place. It's also very important to be protected against the big and catastrophic events. You know, people wind up in hospitals and run up $500,000 of expense. You will absolutely believe that if you're capped at $3,000 out of your pocket, that $500,000 bill, you have been insured. So there's a combination of things going on there. To the other point that was being raised, yes, the absolutely is being part of the debate in Washington right now is to take the individual mandate out of the mix, and the penalty for that mandate would go away in the way the America's Healthcare Act is looking at that. The issue with that would be if you're going to allow people not to be covered, then you've got this other group of people with pre-existing conditions, and that makes it very complicated to have a risk pool that you're covering if people can opt in and out. And many people try and come in right before they have services, and that just is very disruptive to any kind of an economic balance to the pool.
Sure. And in this uncertain climate, I would think a lot of challenges for CEOs like you, looking at lots of different contingencies. What are your final thoughts about the next year or so for your company?
Yeah, no, we are absolutely running multiple scenarios because it is hard to know what is going to happen next. Again, I come back to the cost share reduction. That piece is not yet guaranteed for 2018. And so when we are setting our prices for next year, what we will do is we will put out a price that says, here's how we will be priced for next year. If we do not get a guarantee that the cost share reduction will be in for all of 2018, our prices will have to be 20% higher because we won't have the assurance that it will be in the marketplace. So that's going to be a critical issue. We're going to have to educate people on that. And it's my hope and desire that the work we're doing right now to educate consumers, to educate legislators in Washington, D.C., will help them understand the importance of guaranteeing the cost share reduction for all of 2018 so that we don't have to be looking at large rate increases, and so that the country can be educated on what will the next phase of healthcare reform look like. And hopefully we're going to have about a two-year bridge to bring all of the people who care about that through that process.
We'll keep following it. In the meantime, thanks for giving us your thoughts. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
He's Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity. And much more still ahead on the show. Later.
There's this old phrase that says, the need to know is a wonderful teacher. When you're without a job, it's a wonderful motivator.
Find out about the sweet success of Maple Street Biscuit Company. But up next, it's your I-10 and 95. FDOT on what's about to change. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Vacancies on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have a way of clogging things up.
When it comes to new applications, new filings, major actions, it basically puts a halt to all of those kinds of things. And so it has an impact on really the entire energy industry.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, bureaucratic logjam, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, June 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, this week, it is your chance to come out and learn a little more about a major transportation project in downtown Jacksonville affecting tens of thousands of commuters. Odette Stroys is a spokeswoman for FDOT, the Florida Department of Transportation, and she joins us now with more about what's going on at that big project downtown, the I-10 and I-95 interchange. Two Melissa. Big interstates that come together in Jacksonville.
You say tens of thousands. You made me nervous already.
Good morning. How
good
are you?
Good morning, and thank you for having us on. We really appreciate the opportunity. Well, we're doing some operational improvements and enhancements to the interchange at Interstate 95 and 10. We'll be widening the Fuller Warren Bridge, expanding the northbound and southbound lanes, and adding it from three lanes will become four lanes each way. We're also going to add a very exciting new feature, which is a shared use path. What we're going to do on the Fuller Warren Bridge is add a pathway that's going to be parallel to the southbound traffic lanes, of course, separated by a shoulder and a standard barrier and a tall fence for pedestrians and bicyclists connecting the San Marco and Riverside communities. So that's really exciting. Yes, you will be able to walk across the bridge in 3 years when it is completed. We'll also be providing a dedicated ramp to Irene and Stockton Street to reduce weaving from traffic merging from Interstate 95 southbound to I-10 westbound. We're also building sound barriers for residents along the east side of US 17 northbound, and that will be from McDuff Avenue to Roselle Street, and there'll be new monument signs constructed for Stockton and College Street. So that's about the overview of the entire project.
This is a huge project for Jacksonville, and it's been going on for some time. And you, master brander that you are, Odette, you've given it a name. People can go to the website your10and95.com to learn more about all these improvements. And by the way, why did FDOT decide all these improvements were necessary?
Great question. Glad you asked that. I could depend on you for a good question. Well, these operational improvements are necessary, and it's for your 10 and 95 to cope with the increasing volume of traffic. It's at its capacity right now. Currently, about 250,000 vehicles use the interchange every day. Now, that's expected to rise to about 290,000 vehicles in 2040. So to accommodate that increase, and expansion of the lanes are needed right now. And no, things haven't been going on for a long time. You know, the last time anything was done on the full arm was 2002.
Oh, really?
You know, it just seems like yesterday.
Yeah.
But no, so this is a good time to look at the bridge, see what we can do. And that shared use path is going to be such a wonderful addition for San Marco and Riverside communities.
And it's 549-2937 if you've got a question about the I-10 and I-95 project for Odette Stroys of FDOT. Now, FDOT, by the way, is having an open house about this tomorrow night.
Yes. Now, I would really encourage you, if you have any questions regarding the I-10, I-95 operational improvements project, if it affects you, if you're in the area and you have that question, you've got an opportunity to have one-on-one time with our construction team, FDOT members. All our engineers will be there tomorrow at the FDOT's training center. It's on Edison Avenue, 2198 Edison Avenue. It's just at the corner of Stockton and I-10. Come out tomorrow night from 4:30 to 6:30, and you'll get your one-on-one chance to talk to them. It's informal, no presentations. We'll have all the maps and everything for you to refer to. So we urge you to come out, and we really do hope we have a good showing, because all our entire project team will be there.
And they can really bring people up to date on this. What can people expect as they drive through this interchange for the next 6 months?
Great question. Again, tonight, actually, we're going to have our very first lane closure for this project. We're going to have I-95 northbound's ramp to I-10 westbound, just one lane closed tonight at 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. tomorrow morning for survey work, weather permitting, of course. And we have to do the survey work. We want to make sure everything's going right. Erosion fences will be going up over the next few weeks. And again, you may see those construction crews in the zone of construction influence doing some survey work. In June, construction crews will begin filling in the ponds under I-95 along Riverside Avenue to make way for a parking lot. That's a free parking lot that's going to be constructed on the west side of Riverside Avenue, expecting completion, you know, weather and unforeseen delays, in November of this year. And that's going to be a really great addition for the folks in the Riverside. Always, you know, you and I go there a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everybody who's listening does. No parking, no parking. So there'll be a good-sized parking lot under I-95 on the west side of Riverside Avenue going to be constructed. We're also in mid-June going to have construction crews that may be seen under the Fuller Warren Bridge. They'll be on the water testing the soil foundation. Shouldn't have any impact on the interchange traffic above. And in early fall, that's when the bridge construction is expected to begin, and everything will happen on the south side of the Fuller Warren Bridge. So all the expansion and the shared use pathway will be on the south side of the Fuller Warren Bridge.
How exciting, though, it will be for people to bike or walk across this bridge.
I know.
You can do that over the Acosta, right? But not the Fuller Warren.
But this will be a nice dedicated shared use pathway, or the soup as I've been calling it. Mm-hmm. And there'll also be three lookout points where there's a vantage point for you to look out and take in the view, because I can imagine it'll be quite spectacular. It's quite a high bridge. Mm-hmm. No fishing allowed. Absolutely not.
Very important reminder there. Now, yes. You also oversee another project up in Nassau County. Let's talk about this. This is the first what's called DDI for the whole region. I'd never heard of this till you told me about it. It's a diverging diamond interchange. This is 21st century design.
You got it. It's a European design. The diverging diamond interchange is exceptionally exciting. The actual project in Nassau County consists of 2.2 miles of widening A1A, that's State Road 200, from west of I-95 to west of Still Quarters Road. And it includes the reconfiguration of exit 373, which is to Yulee, Amelia Island, Fernandina Beach, and Callahan. Under I-95, you will, when you're approaching it, briefly travel on the opposite side of the road. And what this will do is it'll eliminate the long left turn across opposing traffic as you merge onto the ramp for the interstate. Now, there are about 60 of these DDIs, diverging diamond interchanges, across the country, and they're all reporting in fewer crashes. Obviously, if you're not crossing a traffic lane and you're just smoothly sliding onto the on-ramp for the interstate, there is no opportunity for a crash, if you will. So, yes, you will briefly travel on the opposite side of the road under I-95, and then you'll come back on the right side of the road. You'll never be on the wrong side of the road, just on the opposite side of the road.
All right, let's go to some calls for Odette Stroys of FDOT, a longtime voice on the air here at 89.9. Doesn't she sound amazing? Don't we all wish we sounded as good as Odette?
I hope I can answer the question as good.
All right, let's go to Jane in Riverside. Hey, Jane, good morning.
Hi, I thought I heard this said as a shared use for pedestrians and people on bicycles. Is that correct?
You are absolutely correct. Yes, you will be able to bike or walk when this is completed in the summer of 2020, depending on weather and, of course, unforeseen delays. You will be able to walk across the bridge or bike ride, connecting the two neighborhoods.
But in the same spot. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Like in the Netherlands, it has 20 million bicycles for 16 million people. The bicyclists and the pedestrians are separated for obvious reason. It's definitely a safety issue. Why would you not separate the pedestrians?
Separate the pedestrians from the bikers? Is that what you're asking, Jane?
That's
okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. All right. Thanks for that.
Odette. We have exceptionally courteous bikers. Bicyclists is what I can say. No, there'll be a mix of bicyclists and pedestrians, and we certainly hope everyone will be extending their arm of courtesy to ensure that there are diligent that there are people walking on the bridge as well as bicyclists.
Because the bigger issue is really more bikes and cars coming into contact with each other.
They
you
will
want
be
to separate the cyclists from the automobiles.
And they will be separated by a 10-foot shoulder, a standard barrier wall, and a high, tall fence. So that will separate us from the vehicles.
And here's a tweet for you. Has Buckman access been considered? It would cut my bike commute to and from Bay Meadows and Orange Park in half.
I cannot speak for that, but I certainly urge you to check nflroads.com. Keep checking back for updates of whether or not we're doing something in that region.
And let's remind everyone again, tomorrow at the FDOT offices at Stockton and I-10, open house.
It's at 2198 Edison Avenue, and that is exactly at Stockton and I-10 area. We have an open house for the I-10, I-95 improvements project. We certainly hope you're there. It's your 10 and 95. It's yours. So come out and talk with everyone 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. tomorrow night.
And if you give her $20, Odette Stroys will record your voicemail message for you. No,
what?
I'm just
$20? That's it?
You should, though. That would be a nice side income for you. I'm just suggesting.
Why, thank you.
She's Odette Stroys, FDOT spokeswoman. Well, they are local restaurateurs who are seeing sweet success with a unique concept. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with Scott Moore and Gus Evans, the founders of the Maple Street Biscuit Company.
Five years ago, two church friends were in the market for a new calling. They found it by creating Maple Street Biscuit Company. Starting with one restaurant in San Marco, Scott Moore and Gus Evans built the concept on a sense of community. In fact, their driving mission is to help people, serve others, and be a part of the community. Today, they have 200 employees, 9 Maple Street Biscuit Company restaurants, and 2 B Street Eats, a new theme. Scott Moore and Gus Evans, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thanks, Karen.
We're happy to be here.
Tell me, what were the circumstances that led to the creation of Maple Street Biscuit Company?
There's this old phrase that says, the need to know is a wonderful teacher. When you're without a job, it's a wonderful motivator. Gus and I, going to church together, we were talking. Well, I'd been an elder in church for several years, and all the elders kind of help people in different roles. And my role kind of was, if you lost your job, come to me. I'd spent time in human resources and operations for the last 30 years. And so Gus had been in construction, and it had dried up. Yep. And So he came to me, and so we put a resume together, went through some job interviews, and he got a job offer in Sarasota.
In Sarasota, right.
And a good job, making more money.
It was. It was a really good job. We had to move down to an area we had no idea of who was down there or what was down there. Even the trees were different down there.
Because Jacksonville was home.
That's right.
So we were going talking through that. I remember we were sitting in a Starbucks over on Roosevelt that has moved now, and I told him that the company I work for had just been brought out by a private equity firm, and he said, what are you going to do? And so I shared with him these five ideas of businesses I could do, because to do what I was doing, I was going to have to move. But we'd made a commitment that Jacksonville was home. So I said, I got to find a way to stay. And so one of those was this restaurant, Comfort Food with a Modern Twist, built around fresh baked biscuits. And candidly, at that time, that was just an idea. There was nothing underneath it. He came back a couple of days and said, hey, I want to do that restaurant idea with you.
Sounds interesting. Let's do it.
My first thought, though, was like, okay, two guys, no restaurant experience, no culinary background, mm-hmm. both without jobs. Oh, yeah, let's go open a restaurant. This is a recipe for failure to go there. And so I looked at him. I said, okay, guys, go home, talk to Kristen, his wife. I said, you guys talk about it, pray about it for a week, and then come back and, you know, if you want to do it, we'll do it. I can tell you, I absolutely knew when he got up from the table, he'd be back in a week and say, no, Kristen, we got two kids. It's got four now, but two. Kristen would look at him and say, you got a job with pay and versus you crazy guys opening something you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. But what happened?
I said I'd want to do that with you. And she was gracious enough to go along with it, and we figured, what do we have to lose? You know, we didn't have to move. We could stay here in Jacksonville, which has been some sweet years since we've made that decision. So it was a good move.
Well, Maple Street. Why biscuits, and why the name Maple Street?
So the idea of biscuits is our very first principle. We have four principles which guide us. One of those is comfort food with a modern twist made consistently. And what I wanted to do with that idea was to say, hey, comfort foods, people, everybody has it, everybody loves it. Comfort, it makes you feel good. But what if we could serve comfort food where people say, hey, I know that, I love it, but I've never had it that way before?
Well, Scott Moore and Gus Evans, founders of Maple Street Biscuit Company, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
And you can read transcripts of Karen Bruni Mathis talks with local success stories in the Financial News and Daily Record. And we'll be right back.
You guys don't have an inkling of what you're about to see if we go in there.
No.
But it's a, you know, privileged area.
Is this the thing about which we spoke?
Oh. There was something on the faces.
Oh, holy moly.
They fill the eye sockets.
Oh my God, there's like a...
They puff out the lips.
Oh, man. On the next Radiolab.
A large, ugly growth.
Tumors.
Famous tumors on the next Radiolab.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Vincent Gardner presents the music of J.J. Johnson.
It's like there was B.J.J. and then after J.J. And after, nothing was the same.
Plus rare, unearthed interviews and stories from his wife, Carolyn.
I made J.J. mop the floor, put the dishes in the dishwasher. I said, you are a celebrity to the world, but you're my husband.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, you can be among the first to experience an amazing blend of science, art, and innovation at the summer exhibit at MOSH, Dinosaurs in Motion. Now, what they've done is put together 14 fully interactive, anatomically inspired, life-sized, recycled metal dinosaur sculptures to engage and educate you and your kids. MOSH curator Paul Borsier is here with a preview of Dinosaurs in Motion and lots of excitement about this. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good to see you. You can't go wrong with dinosaurs, can you?
You cannot go wrong. Everyone is just fascinated with dinosaurs.
Yes.
And this exhibition really is different than the dinosaur exhibits we've had in the past. We're really excited to bring it to Jacksonville. And it's an exhibit so colossal that parts of it can be found on all three floors of the museum. As you mentioned, we have these life-size kinetic sculptures made of repurposed metal of dinosaurs and birds, and they are the work of the late John Payne, a trained metalsmith who was inspired by the dinosaurs on display at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. Mm-hmm. Payne's sculptures combine the art and craft of metalworking with the science of mechanical engineering. So this exhibition is the perfect medium for exploring concepts of STEAM, science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Our guests get to manipulate these giant sculptures with cables, pulleys, remote controls, and motion sensors, and they get to make art and participate in science-based exercises at a series of innovation stations.
There is so much to this, and I'm curious about all the different elements, including the fact that this is recycled material, and also why you chose this exhibit over others that I know you were looking at.
Well, we chose this exhibit because of the STEAM concepts. It brings together art and science and innovation. It's really what MOSH is all about. And to give you an example, the star of the show is the enormous and fearsome Tyrannosaurus Rex. And through his display, visitors explore the world of found art. They experiment with balance and center of gravity. And they operate the dinosaur's massive head and jaws, learning about the biomechanics of the creature's bite force.
What is it like? It's open now, by the way.
People can go now. See
this through September. The kids go crazy for this, but adults will learn a lot, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. We've had adults in there at our exhibit opening. We had a lot of adults in there, and they were just like children. I mean, they just really enjoyed operating these giant sculptures. We had a lot of people doing the interactive elements of the exhibition. And it's really quite dramatic, too, with the uplighting that they have in the exhibit. It's just quite fascinating, and I think people of all ages will really enjoy it.
What's the most popular interactive thing you can do with these dino sculptures? What does everybody want to do?
I think everybody wants to operate the T-Rex.
The T-Rex.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get to operate his jaws?
His head and his jaws. So you can move his head, and you can clang his jaws open and shut.
And see how big those jaws were.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, let's also mention quickly, there is a screening 5 p.m. Friday at the MOSH. It's called Seeing. And this is a movie that's being audio described for the visually impaired. You know, we have our own radio reading service here at WJCT. It's run by our own excellent Michelle Corum. And this is a radio reading service for people with low vision. What's
exactly
this movie Seeing all about?
So it's called Seeing: A Photon's Journey Across Space, Time, and Mind. It's a 25-minute show. It's narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson, the world-renowned director of New York's mm-hmm. Hayden Planetarium. And the show uses hemispheric 2D and 3D animations and video to teach how human vision works. The show follows the life of a photon from its creation inside of a star in the Orion Nebula onto its 1,300-year journey across space through Earth's atmosphere, through a telescope, and into a young stargazer's eye. Then the photon is converted to an electrochemical impulse that travels the neural pathways of the brain to create the image the brain sees. Now, MOSH will be offering this planetarium show at 1 p.m. daily throughout the summer starting June 5th. But as you mentioned, we have a special premiere planned at 5 p.m. this Friday. And in conjunction with the International Association of Audio Information Services, MOSH will present the show in a way that individuals who are blind and visually impaired can better understand what others in the audience are seeing. Trained audio describers will provide a description of the visual elements of the film as it plays.
Pretty awesome.
Yep.
You're a happy curator these days, I think. You got so much going on at the MOSH.
Oh, yeah. Very much.
All right, go to themosh.org for more about Dinosaurs in Motion and all the other exhibits happening there now. Take your kids. You know they want to see those dinosaurs. I'm taking mine, Paul.
Excellent.
My 14-year-old will act like she's too cool for it, but she will secretly really like it. And my 11-year-old will be very excited. So, again, it's themosh.org. He's Mosh curator Paul Bercier and Dinosaurs in Motion, active through September, right there on the South Bank. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the show. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us anytime, or on iTunes. Next on 1A, the Internet's First Amendment, the new fight for net neutrality. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.